Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Esther chapter 6. We'll call this chapter The King Honors Mordecai. Our context is this. In our previous chapter, we saw how Haman had planned to hang Mordecai because Mordecai would not bow down before him, as Xerxes had commanded all of the court officials to do, to bow down before Haman. Mordecai, being a good Jew, would not do that. Esther then agreed to try to get Xerxes' help in order to rescue the Jews from the decree that Xerxes had sent out at the behest of Haman to have all the Jews killed, to have the provincials kill the Jews on Adar the 13th at the end of this year, which was the 12th year of Xerxes. Esther had the banquet. That was the day before. And then the king, of course, is curious. Well, what's your request, Esther? And she says, let's have another banquet. So in chapter 6, where we are now, the first banquet has taken place. After that banquet, Haman, at the behest of his wife Zeresh, had built a tall 75-foot-high gallows in order to hang Mordecai on it. He was going to ask the king the next morning after that first Esther banquet, and after he had gone home and talked to his wife and friends, he was going to hang Mordecai, ask the king to allow him to hang Mordecai on those gallows. And so that day is over, and now we're at the evening time of that day of Esther's first banquet, and after Haman had gone home to talk with his wife. So we start now in Esther 6, 1 and 2. During that night, the king could not sleep, so he gave an order to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. It was found written what Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And of course, King Ahasuerus is Xerxes. Ahasuerus is his Hebrew name. Xerxes is his Persian name. He's more known to world history as Xerxes, so I tend to call him Xerxes. So once again, our time, first one during that night. This is the night between Esther's first banquet and Esther's second banquet. The king couldn't sleep. Now here's some speculations as to why he couldn't sleep. Gil, who is the most expert speculator of all time, says this. Xerxes felt bad because he had neglected Esther so long. Remember, for 30 days he hadn't called her? I don't think so. He couldn't sleep because he was wondering what her request was going to be. Now, he was curious about that, but that's going to keep him up at night? I don't think so. Here's another speculation by Gil. Xerxes was jealous of a possible amorous intrigue that Esther was carrying on with Haman. Oh, really? I don't think so. Gil says that perhaps Xerxes was worried that Haman and Esther were conspiring against his life. And why would he think that? There's no evidence of that either on Haman's part or Esther's part. Gil further speculates that possibly the reason was that the dream was the insomnia was a direct miracle from God, so that Xerxes would have time in the middle of the night while he was up to discover the government's previous neglect of Mordecai, as we're going to see in just a minute. And I suspect it was a natural occurrence. He couldn't sleep. Lots of times people can't sleep. And that was providentially used by God to affect God's purposes, because God is in control of all the events of our lives. Now, the fact that Xerxes had asked for the Book of Records, the Persian government chronicles, the fact that he'd asked for those instead of maybe amusing himself with wives and concubines, or asking some singing men and women to come in and sing him to sleep, or by going out and get a bottle of wine and getting drunk. There's lots of things a king with insomnia could have done, but instead he wants to look over government records. Well, now that shows that Xerxes must have been a pretty good government bureaucrat to want to do something like that. Well, that raises a problem. Why would someone who couldn't sleep read something as boring as government records? Well, here's a couple of possible answers. First, from Adam Clark, all of the government records were written in verse by eminent poets of the Persian Empire. So he's not just reading a government record, he's reading poetry. I don't know why. I have a hard time believing that. The other possible reason why he would want to read something as boring as government records is that it is normal that a king would be interested in his own government. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, doing this is, quote, resorted to not merely as a pastime to while away the tedium of an hour, but as a source of instruction to the monarch by reviewing the important incidences of his own life as well as those of his ancestors. There was, therefore, nothing uncommon in this Persian monarch calling for the court journal, and I think that's exactly right. People whose job it is to govern, they like government, and so he was looking at his government's records. Now, in the records, he found out about Mordecai, Esther's first cousin and adopted father. He found out that Mordecai had squelched a conspiracy against Xerxes' life. The conspiracy was carried out by Bigthana and Teresh. We read about that conspiracy in Esther 2, verse 21. During those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two eunuchs who guarded the king's entrance, became infuriated and planned to assassinate King Ahasuerus. We don't know why they were angry, but they were, and they tried to kill King Xerxes. And Mordecai told Esther, and Esther told the king, and Mordecai got credit for putting down this conspiracy. Now, Bigthan is probably mentioned also in Esther 1:10. On the seventh day, when the king was feeling good from the wine, Ahasuerus, that's Xerxes, commanded Mahuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and there's Bigtha, and some other eunuchs who served him. Now, the commentaries all equate these names. We've got three names for the same guy. Bigtha in verse 1:10, Bigthan in 2:21, and here in Esther 6, verse 2, Bigthana. Bigtha, Bigthan, Bigthana. Why the difference? It's a slight difference. None of my commentaries think it's a big deal. The pulpit commentary says Bigthana is a quote-unquote fuller name, like Daniel is fuller than Dan. So that's not anything to worry about. We go to Esther 6:3. The king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" He's talking to his court officials. Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." Now, what is the king asking about here? The Cambridge commentator says Xerxes probably remembered that Mordecai had uncovered the conspiracy. It's kind of hard to forget something like that. But what he forgot was what reward had been given to Mordecai, as Cambridge said. Well, actually, there hadn't been any reward, but he's trying to place it. He says, "Well, now, wait a minute. He stopped the conspiracy. Did we do anything for him?" He couldn't remember, as the pulpit commentator says, and so he asked about it. And they answer him, "Nothing's been done for him." Well, now here's a problem. Why hadn't Haman already been rewarded? Such royal benefactors usually received a reward, as the NIV Study Bible says. And in fact, it was almost considered a legal right, as Ellicott backs up the NIV Study Bible and says that. This was almost a legal right. And so it was almost like the law had been broken because nothing had been done for Mordecai. In Persia, royal benefactors, quote unquote, formed a distinct class of people. Capital R, capital B, royal benefactors. Well, nobody knows for sure how Mordecai got overlooked. I'm just speculating maybe it was a bureaucratic oversight. Well, those things happen in government. And Mordecai, being the modest man that he was, didn't push for his reward, as the NIV Study Bible says. He just let it go. So we go now to Esther chapter 6, verses 4 through 6. So the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows which he had prepared for him. Remember, he built those gallows the night before. So the sun had just come up, it's early in the morning, and he goes to the king's court, not to go to the banquet, Esther's banquet, but to ask Xerxes for permission to hang Mordecai on the gallows, because Mordecai wouldn't bow down to Haman like he was supposed to. So verse 4 says Haman had just entered the outer court. It doesn't say it was early in the morning, but it was. Haman was hot to get Mordecai hanged, as Adam Clark points out, and as Jameson Fawcett and Brown point out, quote, "This was early in the morning. It is the invariable custom for kings in eastern countries to transact business before the sun is hot, often in the open air, and so Haman was in all probability come officially to attend to his master." Now, I don't know whether Xerxes had gotten back to bed or not, but it was probably early in the morning. Either he stayed up all night or he had gotten back up in the morning. Haman is at the outer court because nobody can go into the inner court without being called, as we saw Esther did that without being called, and she risked her life doing it because the law was, if you come in there without being called, the king, if he doesn't extend his golden scepter in forgiveness to you, the king can have you executed. So he's waiting, Haman was. Xerxes wants to see who's out there wanting to do business, finds out Haman's there, his chief advisor, so of course he says, "Come on in." So Haman came in. And then Xerxes asked him in verse 6, "What is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor?" Now, it was a Persian custom to ask a counselor what should be done for people who needed to be honored. As Jameson Fawcett Brown says, quote, "In bestowing tokens of their favor, the kings of Persia do not at once, and as it were by their own will, determine the kind of honor that shall be awarded, but they turn to the courtier standing next in rank to themselves, and ask him what shall be done to the individual who has rendered the service specified. And according to the answer received, the royal mandate is issued. So everything here is normal according to Persian custom. Now notice that when Xerxes asked Haman, he didn't say what is to be done for Mordecai. He says what is to be done for the man. Mordecai's name is not mentioned. Why did Xerxes not mention Mordecai's name? John Gill speculates it was because Xerxes thought he could better get disinterested advice by not mentioning Mordecai's name. Xerxes, in fact, might have known of Haman's resentment of Mordecai. It was all about the court, that Mordecai would not bow down to Haman, and Haman was upset about it. So it's very reasonable to speculate that Xerxes didn't mention Mordecai because he knew that Haman would not give him objective advice. Now, this is not certain. It's a speculation, but it's reasonable. So when Haman gets the question, he says to himself, whom should the king desire to honor more than me? Here's a problem. How could the author of the book of Esther, whether it was Ezra, Nehemiah, Mordecai, whoever it was, how could the author know the inward thoughts of Haman? Well, the answer is that Haman went home and told his wife Zeresh and his friends what had happened, as we'll see later on in this chapter in verse 13, and the word got out what had happened. Haman conceitedly thought that the king was getting ready to honor him instead of Mordecai. Of course, the irony here is so extremely delicious. Now, it was only natural that Haman thought that Xerxes was referring to Haman himself. The man whom the king desires to honor, Xerxes had said. Haman said, oh, that's me. I've just been elevated by Xerxes to a place of high honor. I have just been given a private banquet with the king and queen. Well, of course, it's very natural that Haman thought it was he that was going to be honored. We go now to Esther 6, verses 7 through 9. Haman told the king, for the man the king wants to honor, have them bring a royal garment that the king himself has worn and a horse the king himself has ridden, which has a royal diadem on its head. Put the garment and the horse under the charge of one of the king's most noble officials. Have them clothe the man the king wants to honor, parade him on the horse through the city square, and proclaim before him, this is what is done for the man the king wants to honor. And of course, he's thinking about himself doing all this, riding around on that horse in the king's robe. Now, this royal garment that the honored man would wear had great significance in the ancient world because a king's garment was very, very significant. In olden times, as the NIV Study Bible says, it was an outward physical representation of a king's power and glory. So if somebody else wore a royal robe, that person was sharing in the king's power and glory. In fact, it was a capital crime to wear the king's robe normally. So if that were true, and it was true, that it was a capital crime to wear the king's robe, and Haman is asking for himself to wear the king's robe, that was a daring proposal. Now, why would he have dared to make such a proposal? Well, John Gill says that because Haman was supremely confident in the answer. After all, he had just had a private banquet with the king and the queen. He had just been elevated to the highest rank in the land. He wouldn't think that Xerxes would want to execute him for riding one of his horses. The NIV Study Bible suggests another reason why Haman would make such a bold proposal that the honored man would ride on a horse. The NIV Study Bible says that Haman would think it would be flattering to the king. Now, I find that a little hard to believe. Why would that be flattering to the king? It would be flattering to Haman, but I don't know why it would be flattering to the king. If he did think that, he sure was cocky. Haman thinks that the king of Persia needed a mere counselor to parade his gown and horse to give honor to Xerxes? I don't think so. But at any rate, another reason why Haman was so cocky as to make such a proposal is because he was an exceedingly proud man. He didn't think anything bad was going to happen to him by asking to ride on the king's horse. He was an exceedingly proud man who fell very, very far, as we'll see in a minute. Now, not only was the honored man to wear a royal garment, according to Haman's suggestion, but also there was to be a horse that the king had once ridden. He had put his royal posterior on this horse, thus giving honor to the horse, and that horse was to be paraded around. Now, we're going to see here, there's a question about whether the horse had a crown on his head and whether this was the same horse that the honored person was supposed to ride on. It's easier to take it this way. The horse had a royal crown on the horse's head, and then The honored person was to get on the horse and ride on that one horse. But it's not necessarily so. As John Gill says, it may have been illegal for anyone besides the king to ride the king's horse. Well, if that's the case, then when the honored person is paraded around in verse 9, it would be on another horse that he's sitting on, not the king's horse. That horse would just be led in state in front with an empty back to represent the king and his glory and his honor, whereas the honored person would ride on another horse behind the king's horse. That's one split of opinion amongst the commentators. Another split is, who's wearing this royal diadem? Let me read the verse again, verse 8. Have them bring a royal garment that the king himself has worn, and a horse the king himself has ridden, which has a royal diadem on its head. Well, it sure sounds like the royal crown is on his head. However, it could have been that the honored person, the man whom the king wants to honor, has a royal diadem on his head. Well, let's look at some of the commentators. Some people say that it's Mordecai. A minority of commentators say it was Mordecai who was wearing the crown. Well, as Ellicott, Poole, and Gill say, there's no mention in the next verse of Mordecai wearing a crown. The author of the book of Esther doesn't mention it. Haman doesn't mention it. And it does mention that he was wearing royal apparel, so why not mention the crown? I think that's a pretty good argument from silence. And so the majority of commentators say it was the horse that was wearing the crown. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, Poole, Gill, and Pulpit all say that. I think they're right. Now, you could argue against that, as Ellicott does, that there's no Persian custom known of horses wearing crowns. Well, so what? Another argument from silence is a little bit weaker, I think. So we're going to assume that the horse is wearing a crown. Now, if the honored person is to ride on the back of the horse or on the back of another horse, he's going to be paraded around through the city square. That procession would probably take several hours. It was a big deal giving the king's honored person glory and honor. We go now to Esther 6, verses 10 through 11. Then the king said to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything of all that you have said. So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. I just love how understated this is. So Haman took the robe and the horse, like, oh, no big deal. I'll just go march Mordecai around and give him honor. Well, it was a big deal. He was getting ready to kill him. I don't know why the verse is so understated there. Now, there's a question. When the king said to Haman, give all this honor to Mordecai, did the king suspect that Haman was proposing the honors for Haman himself? And then he waited and said, aha, I'm going to lower the boom on you, Haman. It's not you that I'm going to give the honor to. It's Mordecai. I suspect that's what happened. I suspect he knew that Haman was expecting the glory to go to himself. That's not stated, and it's a speculation, but I think it's a reasonable one. Now, Xerxes mentions the name, Mordecai, the nationality, the Jew, where he is, sitting at the king's gate, so there's no question as to who is to be honored. Now, you can imagine how Haman felt about this. He must have been totally, utterly mortified. One minute, he's expecting Mordecai to be executed. The next minute, he's lavishly honoring Mordecai with the same honor he had expected to get. So Haman's fall is proverbial. As Adam Clark says, he who digs a pit for his neighbor is sure to fall into it himself. Jesus himself said in Luke 6:38, for with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. That was a proverb, too. And so this is really proverbial here. What happened to Haman? We go now to Esther 6, 12 through 14, and we'll finish this chapter. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. Holman Christian Study Bible has king's gate capitalized. New American Standard does not, so it's a gate that goes into the king's palace, and there's an outside city square courtyard that got you into the king's palace. And that, of course, is where business, legal matters and business matters were conducted, and that's where Mordecai, as a king's official, was doing his business. Mordecai returned to the king's gate after his honorable procession through the city square being led by Haman. But Haman, overwhelmed, hurried off for home with his head covered. Overwhelmed, I guess he was. His head covered with shame. Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened. His advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, since Mordecai is Jewish and you have begun to fall before him, you won't overcome him because your downfall is certain. While they were still speaking with him, the eunuchs of the king arrived and rushed Haman to the banquet Esther had prepared. Now, why did Zeresh tell Haman that he was cooked? His downfall was certain. because Mordecai is Jewish. In other words, everybody knew that Haman had sponsored the edict that Xerxes had sent out to the provinces that all the Jews were going to be killed on Adar 13. But now a Jew has been elevated to great honor. Well, you put two and two together. Oh, so Haman tried to kill the Jews, and Mordecai is Jewish, and now Mordecai has power. You are in deep doo-doo, hubby dear. Isn't that great to have a wife there to comfort you in your misery? And his friends, too, were there and said the same thing. You've had it. And they were entirely correct, because Haman is going to get hoisted on his own petard, as the proverb has it. He's going to get strung up on those gallows, 75-foot gallows. Now, Haman probably didn't need his wife and friends to tell him that he was in trouble. He no doubt feared that worse things were to come. Haman didn't know whether or not the king knew that Esther and Mordecai were Jewish. So there's a possibility they did know that Esther and Mordecai were Jewish, and Haman, contemplating that possibility, would think, ooh, Xerxes is going to be mighty ticked off at me because I ordered the execution of all the Jews, which would include the queen, and which would include Mordecai, who has just been honored as having saved Xerxes' life from a conspiracy. I am in so much trouble. So he knew bad things were coming. And then, while he's contemplating this, of course, is in the daytime after Mordecai had been honored, messengers come from the king, eunuchs come, and they rushed Haman to Esther's second banquet. Now, before we go to that, let's look at some of these friends that were advising Haman in his house. It says they were his advisors. The New American Standard Translation has it as his wise men. Now, that means his advisors could have been magicians and soothsayers. In other words, people who dabble in the occult arts, people who converse with demons. I'm sure the demons weren't happy about what's happened here. They realized that they'd been outfoxed by a sovereign god. Now, these advisors and friends and wife who tells Haman that his downfall is certain because Mordecai is Jewish, they knew that Mordecai wasn't going to take Haman's anti-Jewish edict lying down. They knew that Mordecai was coming after him. In other words, they didn't have to be so wise to understand this. Any moron would have known it. Now, when Zeresh, the wife of Haman, says, Haman, your downfall is certain, the Septuagint adds there, for the living God is with him. The living God is with Mordecai. Now, Adam Clark says, that's strange for a heathen to say this. Now, this is only in the Septuagint, not in the Masoretic Hebrew text. I speculate here that maybe Haman knew enough of Judaism to know what the Jews thought of their God. And maybe Zeresh knew it too. At any rate, it was true. The living God was with Mordecai. All right, so the eunuchs show up from the king's palace. It was customary for a message to be sent at the day and hour of a banquet. It was also customary for an invitation to be sent by court officials, by eunuchs, but not only the invitation, but an announcement that the banquet's ready to make sure everything's ready. And so they show up, and Haman is rushed off to the banquet. Now, why was he rushed off to the banquet? As verse 14 says, rushed. Well, maybe it was customary not to keep the king from having to wait, so you got to hurry to get there to keep him happy. This is Esther's second banquet. We can imagine that Haman had lost his appetite to go to the second banquet at this point. And on this tragic note, we will end our discussion of Esther chapter 6. That prepares us to go in our next audio to Esther 7, and we're going to see Haman hanged. I hope you stay tuned for that bloody event in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.